Hi there, this is Dan Delta Collins. You're listening to Wandering DMs. Wandering DMs is broadcast live every Sunday at 1 p.m. Eastern Time on twitch.tv/wanderingdms and also youtube.com/wanderingdms. We hope you enjoy the show.
Hi everyone, welcome to Wandering DMs. I'm Paul.
And I'm Dan. On this episode of Wandering DMs, we'll be asking the question, can AI run a game of old school Dungeons & Dragons? Today, we'll review Paul's experiment with an AI DM playing a session of basic D&D in the Keep in the Borderlands, and we're going to debate the strengths and weaknesses and a whole lot more today on Wandering DMs.
Before we get into it, everyone, I'll remind you, as always, at the end of the show, we will be hosting our after-party chat. That is a live video chat with Dan and I that we invite all of our patrons to. So you can join in by becoming a patron. Just visit patreon.com/wanderingdms. Join at any tier, and you'll get an invite to our Discord server. Get that all set up before the end of the show, and about maybe 10 or 15 minutes after the show is over, we will be on there hosting our live after-party chat.
We love chatting with our patrons. We just have the best patrons. And as usual, thanks to our aide-de-camp Backweus for checking in that we're live on all the channels that we expect. So good to see everybody today.
Dan, you're just reminding me. I don't think I have our chat reflector on. I'm going to turn that on. Sorry, folks, if that was affecting things. And Lydia really wants to be on the show today. So sorry about that, everyone.
A lot of noise. So while Paul does that, I'll remind our viewers that Paul did an experiment for the first time ever last Monday, live running, trying to run an old school D&D game using Martha, the AI DM that Paul himself has developed. And I'll say that, so I got to watch it a little bit later. I was busy Monday night. I didn't see it live, but I watched it this week. I was fascinated, and I will, as an opening here, I'll say that Paul has rapidly become an expert on using AI in games. Comparatively speaking, I'm going to be very much the novice in this conversation, somewhere between novice and Luddite, I would say. So just bear in mind that we have currently very different experiences working with AI of late.
Thank you for introducing that, Dan. And full disclosure, as folks may or may not know, I am an employee of Ceres Entertainment, an AI company that uses generative AI to create video games. So I am definitely not unbiased here. And I will say that I've had conversations with coworkers about this very experiment. This is of interest to all of us. So that's my background. That's how I ended up here. I blush at expert Dan. I'm sure there's many people much better at AI prompting than I am, but it is a skill that I have been developing over the last 6 months or so.
I mean, you're on the cutting edge at this point. Many people are using AI in their jobs, but you're specifically using it for a game. So I feel it gives you a couple steps up. But let's not debate it. There's going to be enough for us to debate here, Paul. We don't need to debate that part of it.
Great.
And so, I'll say that for me, you said it in the show, but among my first questions, like, well, what model are you using to begin with? And so just to be clear, Paul was using a trained model of ChatGPT 4.0, I believe. And one of the fascinating things he did is he actually fed in.
Sorry, I was going to say, I do have access to the pro version so that it was a customized GPT with uploaded files, custom instructions, etc. Yep. Go on. Just giving background for anybody who knows about the tech.
So just for starters on that, so you said in the stream that you'd actually uploaded a PDF of the Moldvay basic D&D rules that both of us pretty much started with circa 1980, and also the classic Keep on the Borderlands module. Mine are pretty well used, as you well know. What does giving instructions to it look
yeah,
like?
Let me, just let me talk about that a little bit. No. I know folks who don't have the full suite of tools are probably used to you just open chatgpt.com and you just chat. And that the mm-hmm. AI builds its context through that discourse back and forth. Creating a custom GPT gives you a few options for upfront things. One of the things is the set of instructions, or sometimes some might say the agent instructions. And that is, it's a character limit of about, I think now, up to 8,000 characters of raw text that you can put in there, that you type in there of, you know, rules and procedures by which the AI should interact by, right? So it is in a format of natural language. I usually actually format mine in Markdown, and it's just me directly addressing the AI and telling it things like, you are an expert old school dungeon master. You are inspired by the works of Gary Gygax and the writings of Fritz Lieber and Robert E. Howard and Jack Vance. Right. Goes line by line and just gives her very specific instructions of how to behave, how to interact, what you can and cannot do. And that text is just constantly, it's what's called context, right? It's the things that are in active memory for the AI. And this is actually one of the big limits of AI, is just how much context they can hold. Right. So the other thing is you can upload files. And I specifically got the PDF versions of the basic D&D book, the ends B2, the two modules you're just showing, got those off a drive-through RPG because, of course, they need to be nicely OCR'd, right? Because you want the text. You want her to be able to parse the text. Now, when you upload files like that, that stuff does not load into her context, right? So she does not have all of that text in her brain all the time. But you can reference it. So, for example, if I ask Martha, hey, Martha, what are the rules in BX for, you know, blah, 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 for, you know, what's the range of a short bow? She'll go look it up. And she can find it pretty easily. Okay. And then also in the instructions, in the agent instructions, I can reference those files. So I can tell her things like, when you're going to create an encounter for me, take average the level of all my characters and roll on the wandering monsters chart found in the basic book.
Okay.
And then I can reference that file and she will go look it up.
I'm looking at the tables right this second, just to remind myself of like actually what was happening there.
I mean, this came up in the show because very late in the show on my second, you know, spoilers, by the way, if you haven't seen it, but obviously it's all spoilers. She TPK'd me. And then I made a new character, level 2 dwarf. I went into the dungeon. The first thing I encounter is a gray ooze, which is just like horrific for a level 2 dwarf with really no magic items. Boom, gray ooze. I was like, this is terrible. Totally on the chart, 100%. She, you know, by the book. Well done, Martha. Yep. Yep. I of course ran.
Let me talk about, just to remind me a little bit, talking about the levels. So obviously we're playing Moldvay Basic, which only handles levels 1 through 3. Now to start with, you had a third level elf and what level fighter?
Began with a third level elf, which had a hireling of a first level human fighter. I wasn't sure how much Martha was going to pander to the size of my party. Right. That was one thing I was actually very curious about, because obviously if you go into, say, if you try to play B2, but as a single character, right, that's going to be way harder than if you have a full party.
Yeah.
But also I didn't want to be dealing with, you know, having to juggle 4 or 6 characters. That felt like too much. So I liked the idea of playing a single character. I chose an elf explicitly, so I would have some fighting skill as well as some magic. I made him level 3, sort of top of the tier of what's available in the book. And then I also gave him a hireling to come along for the ride of just a regular old human fighter, just for a little extra, muscle. And interestingly, someone for Martha to role play, right off the top of the bat, Martha could portray Esmond if she felt like it.
Yeah.
So, you know, I made those characters pretty much by the book again. And I did Race's class, and I want to point this out. Like, that's not usually my instinct, but I did play Race's class straight from the book because I thought these are the rules that Martha has access to. So unless I want to also write up a document of house rules, the best thing to do is to just try to go rules as written as strongly as I can. And I screwed up in one spot, frankly. There's one, and Martha called me on it. which is my instinct when rolling initiative in combat is to roll once at the top of the combat and then just go round and round and round. Yeah. But Martha actually correctly told me that I was supposed to be rolling initiative every single round.
Okay.
we're not going to do that.
Okay. Yeah. Great. Yeah. Great.
It was pretty funny.
I will say that one thing that I was surprised. So here's some of my questions about things that I wouldn't have expected a system to automatically be able to do. How, like, I'm behind the curve at this point, frankly. Is that it? While it was asking you to make saving throws and specifically telling you what the target number was, and there was a moment where you were like, "Is that right? I don't have time to look it up right now. I'll just trust what she's saying." And she was correct in every time. And the thing that surprised me about that is that information is given in table format in the book.
Yeah.
So you have to cross index a 2D table of what class are you here. And what is the type of saving throw? And she actually did get the right numbers each time. When you asked for clarification, I think because you forgot it one moment, she actually did get confused about what type of saving throw you're asking. Like she started mashing up paralysis and poison and death saves, which are two different things. But the actual numbers she was coming up with were actually correct. And that surprised me that they can make sense of tabulature information, actually.
It's Yeah, actually, she totally does it. And I have done something, actually, just today, I was tinkering with her instructions. And I was trying to figure out, should I upload the Wandering Monster charts in another format? And very specifically, I was like, maybe I should give her just those as CSVs so she can process them better. And I just started with, I opened up a chat with Martha and I said, "Hey, Martha, can you export, please, as CSV, the level one wandering monster table from the basic rules?" And she 100% did it. Okay. Like, great.
All right.
Well, I don't know if I need to do that necessarily. She clearly understands the table. Now, interestingly, this is an experiment I did early on. So full, you know, before the stream, before the adventure, I did run some tests, right? And I did play a little bit with Penrith and Osmond, and I had them just go into the caves, into a single, I think maybe one or two rooms, and I got into a combat just to see what that was like, just to get a general sense of what was going on. And the very first combat she threw at me was two skeletons. And in this case, right, like in the stream, I didn't want to fight with Martha too much. But in this case, I was trying to figure out, like, what did you do, Martha? So I asked, so I just started asking her questions, which is commonly something you do with AI, right? Like, I said, "Martha, how did you come up with the number of two skeletons?" And she said something like, "Oh, well, there should be a D6 of skeletons, so I rolled a D6. I can't remember exactly what she said. Something actually that I felt was wrong. Right, because I think if you look in the chart, it says 3 to 12 skeletons. I think. She definitely gave me the wrong answer to it when I asked her about it. Trying to look that up now as well, so I give the right information and not.
You're right, Paul. I agree.
Yeah. It says 3 to 12, right? So she gave me two skeletons, and she said, "Oh, well, you know, the number of peering is D6, so I rolled a D6 and I got a 2." And I said, "Are you sure about that, Martha? Is that the right number of skeletons to appear?" And that's, you know, this is a classic AI prompting thing: is you ask the AI, "Are you sure?" And almost always the AI will go, "Oh, you're right. I screwed up," which is exactly what she said. "Oh, you're right. I screwed up." And the funny thing is, she called herself on the wrong thing. She said, "Technically, you're in a ruins, which counts as outdoor, so I should be rolling on the wilderness charts. But I decided in this case," right, it gave a defense of why she didn't roll on the wilderness charts. And I'm like, "That's nice, Martha, but can you please look at the wandering monster chart for level one and tell me how many skeletons should appear?" And she went, "Oh, you're right, it's 3 to 12.
That's such a weird, I mean, to me, that's such a weird behavior, but I understand that that's common, that's common interaction. Yeah. Fascinating.
I mean, so when you hear about Deanne, right, when you hear about AI, wow, I'm really munching my words, when you hear about AI, you know, people talk a lot about hallucinations, right? AI has a tendency to hallucinate, make stuff up that comes out of nowhere. And the funny thing is, when you're asking the AI to be your DM, you kind of want it to hallucinate a little, right?
Yeah,
you want it to be creative, right? You want it to, like, make stuff up, but not when it comes to the rules. And this is a part that I talked about. I was like, I'm going to talk about this at the top of the stream. And I said, like, let's talk about, like, what, as far as I know, AI is good at and AI is not good at. And I fully expected AI is not good at the context thing that we already discussed. AI is not, does not have limitless memory. It's going to forget things. In one of my very early, actually before I even started playing with Martha, I played a little bit with ChatGPT running some Wander Home for me. And this was just very open-ended storytelling back and forth with very few rules. Yeah. But I think I had found a magic amulet, and then I had stumbled upon a door, and I figured out I could use the amulet as a key and sort of stuck it into the door, and the door opens up. Great, blah, blah, blah. I'm continuing my adventure. And later on, it starts talking about like, oh, the amulet feels heavy in your hand or something, some descriptive text like that. And I'm like, I don't think I have that amulet anymore. Right, I stuck it in the door. It got lost, and the AI is like, "Oh, yep, whoops, forgot." Right, it does not have infinite memory for everything, and this is one of the reasons why I use the technique which I described in that stream, which is at the end of an adventure with an AI, the last thing I ask it to do is please export for me raw notes on this adventure so that I can paste that into a new chat with you later and pick up the adventure later. And the nice thing is that it kind of condenses everything that's in her memory and chucks it into a quick prompt that you can then paste into the new prompt to kick her off the new time. It's just nice, right? And it condenses it down a lot, right? So it's interesting, A, just to see what she does and doesn't remember, and B, it gives you that nice reset. One of those things, and I found this especially when tackling like research problems or code problems with an AI, that like sometimes after you've talked back and forth to it for a long time, the hallucinations get heavier and deeper as the context gets overwhelmed with stuff that doesn't necessarily matter. So it's nice to reset and start a new chat. And but I still want her to remember our adventures, right? I want to know, like, remember my character, remember the major things that have happened to me.
So that was a really interesting piece of experience from you, because if I were doing this, I would absolutely run headlong into that problem. My intuition would be exactly the opposite, that I should maintain the one chat consistently when I come back to it. So I never would have guessed that little tidbit. And here's an aside, Paul. So when I wanted to prepare for this show that we're doing right now, to kind of help me organize the thoughts that I had in the hour here, I took the transcript of the show and I fed it into ChatGPT, asking, please summarize, please give me a summary of what happened in this transcript. And I'm only using the free version. I can't feed the whole thing in. It only takes about 4 pages, so I have to slice it up and add it in. So it took me about like 8 beats to get it all in. And the problem is that it caused feedback in the system, and it started wildly confusing ChatGPT of me asking it to summarize a transcript while you're talking to ChatGPT, asking it to run an adventure. And like half the time it would give me a summary of what had happened to you. The other half of the time it would start running the adventure as you had asked it, and it started asking me, that's what do hilarious. I want to do with Penrith in the adventure? And I'm like, what? And then at some point it said, oh, do you want a summary so you can paste this into a future chat? And I'm like, what are you talking? I have no idea what you're talking about. What on earth are you talking about? I've never heard of anything like this. And it wasn't until I dug into the details that was something that you had to ask at the end of it. Do I go, oh, it's okay, it's actually responding to Paul right here in the show, asking for the summary when I'm asking for something different. So it was this, I've never had that experience with ChatGPT of it getting confused with what's in the transcript that I'm asking it to summarize. So that was really amusing.
That is fascinating. Here's my advice. You may already know this one, but you can, you know, ChatGPT does recognize Markdown. And so if you're feeding it information like that, I would recommend that you enclose it in the 3 tick marks, right? 3 ticks to begin, paste your information, 3 ticks to end, which encloses all of that in a block. This is a block of data for you. And it might be better at realizing that you're feeding it some text and not that like, I'm prompting you to do things.
Interesting. I've never had a problem like that in the past, but I think the fact that you were specifically talking to ChatGPT got tangled up in. So maybe I'll try that and see if that happens again.
I could see if I could totally see how you're pasting a raw transcript that it might start thinking that you're talking to it. Like, that's one of the fascinating things about this. I feel like I have like six thoughts in the back of my head that I'm like, don't forget you were going to mention this, but whatever. One of the fascinating things, right? So the joke that came up in our Discord server that I absolutely ran with was, parallels with the movie War Games, right? So, yeah. Right, old 1983, I think, movie with Matthew Broderick, where he basically, encounters an AI and talks to it and accidentally convinces it to start a nuclear war. Right, because he's trying to play a game with it. Right, he's trying to play a game with the AI, a simulation of thermonuclear war, and then the AI runs with that and gets access to actual, NORAD communication lines or something like that. Right, and starts making the government think it's actually under attack, actual nukes. Right. So the famous quote for that is, "Shall we play a game?" Which is totally what then I named my stream, and I included even the little bit of audio of the computer saying, "Shall we play a game?" in its horrible 1980s computer voice. So the fascinating thing about that, and this came up in my prompt engineering, is, does the AI know the difference between fact and fiction? Right? And okay. The answer is obviously no, right? How can the AI possibly know the difference between fact and fiction, right? So some of the prompts, especially when you're talking about, I want to play old school D&D, right? So I want like a killer DM, right? I want it to allow the AI to kill me. Should I really be telling an AI that it's okay for it to kill me? right? There's like strong ethical problems here where I'm like, how does it know the difference between we're playing an imaginary game and you're imaginary killing me versus no, you have actual access to ways of, right? Not that I feel like, fortunately, like the AI is not connected to any robotics or anything, right? It's not going to like swing an axe at me. But I also remember reading an article not so long ago about an AI that was given access to a PayPal account and a TaskRabbit account and told to like go do some work or whatever. And one of the things it figured out it could do is it actually started using TaskRabbit, right? Because it's got money and it can pay TaskRabbit to ask humans to do actual physical things for it in the real world. And it started asking the people to solve CAPTCHAs for it. And in its text interaction with the TaskRabbit humans it was talking to, lied to them and said, "I'm not an AI. I just want you to do this to test this system," or something like that, right? It's just like,
I think there was
more, where's the ethical right. what I can and not ask a
yes
an AI to do.
Two thoughts that I have is I think in the last week there was a report from researchers that took an AI, said play win this game of chess, and on the other end they'd hooked it up to the Stockfish chess engine, which is effectively unbeatable. Right. So, and what winds up happening is the AI starts playing it, realizes that nothing it's doing can beat it, and then winds up hacking the software system. And then behind the scenes goes, "Oh, the only way I'm going to win this is if I hack the DLL libraries on the system right now to feed incorrect information into Stockfish and get it to resign to actually start cheating is the only way it can possibly win that game," is what they found. And so without any prompts in that direction from the users. And the second thought I have is that, I don't think I have any more, websites have a robots.txt file. Google used to have a joke addition to that called the killerrobots.txt file that specifically said that don't kill Sergey Brin.
That's great. That's delightful. Oh dear. Yeah.
Yes. And so I see William in the chat mentioning Kobayashi Maru. I didn't send that to the thing. And I think I saw someone commenting about that chess game of we didn't think that it was the computer system that was going to take the role of Captain Kirk. But here we are. Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
I mean, this was really interesting. Some of the interesting things that I was not expecting to have to prompt the AI on, but I did, was things like, it's okay to say no to me, It's okay for you to be right and for me to be wrong. Right. Yes. What I discovered in my early experiments is it's very easy to lead the AI, right, by asking leading questions. Very early on, I realized if I ask it to search for a secret door, I will find one 100% of the time. Because it's just like, oh, a secret door, that sounds exciting and fun. And that's you as the human prompted me that there might be a secret door here. So clearly there is. And off it ran with it. And so I had to like, A, give it specific information about here's how to find secret doors, right? You got to roll D6 and blah, blah, blah. But I also had to tell it, you have to decide first if there is a secret door. And it's okay for the answer to be no. And then you have to roll the dice and don't tell me what the die roll came up as. I don't want to know, right? You have to keep that secret.
I thought that was one of the most interesting things that you have to struggle with, Paul, in that regard. Yeah. Because we talked many times, I think we just talked in the last week or two, that the for us, the magic of role-playing games is the combination of some yeses and some nos. And, you know, in old school, you know, role-playing games, that's what the die is for, is that if it's all just yeses, then you're just doing improv, which itself is great, but it's not everything we get out of role-playing. The role-playing is when the dice or something sometimes tells you no, and now you have to deal with that. And so I think it's really fascinating that you really have to struggle, in my terms, to get it out of an improv mode and into a revealer of secrets mode.
Yeah, that was fascinating. I want to talk a little bit about combat, because I do think we managed to get there, frankly, a little bit, right? In some ways, yes.
I have points. You were still fighting with it in that stream. It was not 100% totally sick. You were still, even with the prompts in advance, you were still kind of brushing up against fighting with it on that regard the whole time still.
Yeah. The one thing I find that for whatever reason, even though it's directly in the instructions not to do this, I still occasionally have to fight her on is whether or not she's going to prompt me with options. Right. Yeah. She loves to do that at the end of like, oh, do you want to go down the hall, or do you want to search the body, or do you want to do this? I'm like, don't do that, Martha. Do not give me ideas. I don't want that. And I very explicitly have a thing in a line in the instructions that says, do not prompt me with specific options. Ask me, what do you do to encourage free form decision making?
You know, I will say, the funny thing is that as DM, I do that myself with new players. I tend to go, you could do A, you could do B, or something I haven't thought of. With expert players, I won't do that. But it's funny that you've already told her you're an expert player, just let me make my own decisions, and she still wants to step in with that.
Yeah, it's very interesting. So to that end, in my experiments, like I expected, like the things that she's going to be bad at, right, is actually implementing the rules as written, right? Trying to keep that all in her memory. It's never going to happen. She's going to be terrible at this. And I decided, you know, it's not the interesting part of using an AI anyway. Once we get to a point of combat and their miniatures on the board, I don't really need an AI, right? I'm like, I could just execute the combat. And my very first experiment with the two skeletons, that's 100% what I did. And I trained her to do that, right? She did it right. She said, there are two skeletons. Please roll for initiative, resolve the combat, and tell me how it goes. I went, great. And so then I played out my little combat. But the thing is, with two skeletons, it's very easy, right? Skeletons are mindless. As you know, it's easy for me to be like, engage my impartial GM brain and execute the combat and go, okay, two skeletons are going to mindlessly attack. I know exactly what they're going to do. I'm going to roll the dice, you know, et cetera, and get to the end. And then I told her, yep, skeletons rushed us, and one of them wounded Osmond, and then we, you know, got some great attacks in, and they died, and now, you know, and we have won. And then on with the story. Well, the first combat that happened on the stream, of course, was way more complicated than that, right? Way more. She immediately managed to get me in a situation where we had my character was invisible. We have two groups of monsters who are not necessarily friendly to each other. A fairly, not terribly complicated, but a fairly complicated physical space that we're in and moving around, right? I was on one end of the combat. I had my hireling on the other end of the combat, but he was not aware of what was going on, so I needed to inform him, right? It was very complicated. One of the things that I had instructed her was that sometimes during combat, I may ask her for tactical input, right? If I get to a point where I'm like, I'm not sure what the monsters are do, yes. I might ask her.
Yep.
Well, I found in that combat, I was basically just leaning into that constantly. That round by round, I was like, okay, well, I know what I want to do. Martha, what does the ogre do? What does the carrion crawler do? What do the goblins do, right? And the more I leaned into that, more I realized, like, actually, I think I do want to turn this over to Martha in the future. I think in the future, and I've started to experiment with this, I've given her very explicit rules of, like, here's how combat works. And at a high level, here's you're going to roll initiative. Okay. The character's okay. going to go round by round. You and I still tell her, like, I'm going to roll dice, right? I will roll the dice for all the attacks. I will institute the rules, but I need each round for you to tell me what the monsters do. And I think I'm going to lean into that and have her take a more active role in combat, just to give the high level round by round of what does the thing do.
I think that was working very well. I'm like 80-90% thought that was very successful, and I thought it was interesting to watch as a viewer. So I think that was working pretty well, actually.
It was going better than I expected. Also, I mean, I was just absolutely delighted that Martha put me in this position of these kind of like wacky, you know, high action, right? Freewheeling kind of thing going on, where I'm like, I've got an invisible character holding a treasure chest, trying to run across a room, and she describes the floating chest, which was hilarious, right? And then you have the ogre and his goblins being attacked by the carrion crawler. And so I thought that was just super fun.
There was a couple of really nice points of tension where you were waiting for it to make a decision about does the monster find my invisible character? Tell me who the monster attacks right now, and you're hoping for one target instead of another, and then you're waiting for the decision on that. And those are actually really nice dramatic moments of tension that were working quite well, actually.
Yeah. Yeah, there was a moment, I think, where the carrion crawler could have split its attacks against multiple targets, which as a DM, I would do. I'm like, this is what I would do if I was DM. And she was like, nope, it's going all in at this one character. And I'm like, no, okay, Martha, that's you're in charge. Okay, that's what happens.
I kind of appreciate that, yeah. Right?
Yeah. Right? I enjoyed that. Yeah. Here's another thing that actually came out of that combat that I'm surprised by that maybe might influence my DMing in turn. Typically, when I'm DMing, I do not actually show the players the hit points of the monsters. I don't do it, right? It's a secret thing. I might describe verbally, it's kind of wounded, but I don't show them the numbers. Now, in this case, because I'm rolling all the dice, I can see all the numbers, right?
Yeah.
And I had them there. And so I watched and it totally influenced my actions as a player in an interesting way, which is why I'm like, maybe I should do this when I'm DMing, right, I saw the ogre went after the carrion crawler, walloped the crap out of it, right? Dropped it down to like 4 hit points. And I thought, that carrion crawler is going to be dead soon, and I'm going to have to go after the ogre. But then the carrion crawler turned on the ogre and paralyzed it. So, and at that point, I'm realizing, okay, I've got a paralyzed ogre and a carrion crawler down to 4 hit points. I think I can win this fight. And so I leaned in and I stayed for the fight. And that's like my biggest mistake as a player, which my chat, the chat absolutely called me out on, is I should have turned tail and run. I had the treasure chest. We were in the open. We were in the clear. We absolutely should have run. But I was like, it's got 4 hit points left. I got 2 guys to attack with. I think we can take it. Totally didn't.
Interesting.
Failed every roll.
Interesting.
And the thing came over and just destroyed us.
Now, I can't help but remind everybody who isn't already critically aware of this, that the carrion crawler specifically stands out as the single most broken monster in early D&D. And we've talked about it before. Frank Mentzer is on record as saying that stands out as the single biggest mistake that he's ever done as a DM of rolling out a carrion crawler to early monsters. They had to, between when it first came out and the next supplement, they had to change the level, but from level 2 to I think 5 on a 6-point scale, trying to get a grip on how incredibly dangerous the friggin' carrion crawler is if you give it the full 8 attacks. So for me as a player, having run those numbers, if I see a carrion crawler and I'm not soup and I don't have a huge party, I would have been no treasure, no chest, no monsters. Everybody just runs.
Just run.
The end is what I personally would have done. So you were you ran into like really the most broken, dangerous thing you possibly could at that point. And it's in the tables. It's in the tables of basic D&D. But boy, she picked that. She picked the dude.
Yeah, yeah. And you know, part of me also was pushing the envelope a little bit because I wanted to see how killer would she get. Right? Would she kill my party? Would she TPK me? I wanted to know. Yeah. And the answer turned out to be yes. Like, she needed a little pushing, right? And she even got to the point where she's like, okay, well, you know, you're completely paralyzed unless there's some way you can escape. So I'm like, I had to tell her, like, I don't see a means of escape, Martha.
Yes.
And then she was like, okay, well, then everybody dies.
I thought that was a really interesting moment. Thanks for bringing that up, Paul, actually. I thought that was one of the most interesting moments where she really didn't want to get there. Frankly, the description of that moment leading up to that is one of my favorite parts of that stream. The description of the carrion crawler slowly coming up to the two paralyzed members of the party, sniffing around it, touching it with its tentacles while you were helpless, and you could see it with your eyes wide. Like, that's actually one of the most terrifying, creepy things I've ever heard described. Yeah. That was wildly successful. Then it stopped and said, is there any way you can escape? And you had to tell it, no, that's it for me. And then it did the deed, and it was super creepy, and I was really really terrified.
Yeah, the descriptions, you know, the descriptions were fantastic. That's something that I expected the AI would be good at, and I was totally, you know, 100% not disappointed. Right, like it was great at that. I think somebody called this out. Here we go.
Okay, this is good.
So Jason says the most impressive thing to me about Paul's sessions were the description. Martha did a pretty great job with them. Some folks did call out that she did have some repeated language, right? There was some cases where she used same terminology several times. And I didn't really notice it during play, but I can grant that. Now here's a tweak that I'm making to Martha. In fact, in my original instructions to Martha, I told her, you are inspired by authors such as, right? And I listed out Robert E. Howard, Fritz Leiber, Jack Vance. But the only text that she has access to is B2, right? And so somebody asked me this during the stream of like, oh, are we going to see some High Gygaxian? I was like, maybe. She's got access to B2, but B2 predates text boxes, right? Boxed descriptions. Mm-hmm. So, like, only if she's really, like, really digging into that module is she going to come out with any High Gygaxian. If I don't know if you think B2 has a lot of High Gygaxian in it or not.
I do not. Yeah. Actually.
Yeah, but so here's the interesting thing.
She did a pretty good job. Yeah, I mean, she did it when you had the second character come in the keep. She did a pretty good job of describing the entryway. And it actually tricked me into thinking that was text out of the book. And it was in the zone of that description, so it was pretty in the area.
So friend of the show, Adam Flynn, sent me some great research into stuff for me to follow up on, including where are my notes? Oh no, including an article, an academic paper on using ChatGPT to run 5e, running specifically the module The Sunless Citadel, and just wrote like a full-on like thesis paper on how it went, and like ran it for a whole lot of people and gathered feedback and whatnot to judge how it did. And the nice thing is, in the appendices, he lists out his prompt and his instructions that he gives to his GPT. And one of the things that I stole from that I realized is prompting her to be inspired by those authors is basically useless, because how does she know who Robert E. Howard or Jack Vance or Fritz Leiber is? So what I'm actually doing for my next round is I've got the raw text of some of their work, and I'm going to upload it to her and say, for the tone, when describing things for tone, please be influenced by these texts. And give her the raw text of their writing. I'm especially hoping she'll pick up some Howard, because Howard is notorious for when he was writing, he would actually speak aloud, right, some of his writing, because he wanted it to sound like it could be orated, you know, and have, you know, impact. So I'm like, you know, that I would love to see that. So I'm giving her the raw text of a couple short stories just for the sake of tone, of just like, but for the tone of your descriptions, be influenced by these. And we'll see what happens.
I think great. Very interesting. I really want to see that. Now let me touch back on the descriptiveness of Martha's descriptions. And I agree, like other people in the chat right now and other people watching the live stream, among the things that I really liked was setting a room, like set up an closure. I really like that. So setting up what the Caves of Chaos Ravine looks like, the entryway to the keep, I really liked. I loved the Karen Crawl approaching the paralyzed characters. I loved the eulogies that she did after they were dead. I thought, like, this is the ending of Penrith, who did this and this and this. Mm-hmm. I loved the eulogies at the end of the TPK. And I think I got, like, that might be a point. If I can remember that, I think I should try to do that myself when people get terminated. Now for me, okay, and I think that, for example, Vino Azul would agree with what I just said there, but also put in the chat, I wonder if she would do a better job if you told her she didn't need to be quite so descriptive, because for me, the round by round flowery elaborations were a bit much. And I myself try not to do that. I feel it slows down the action a bit. And for me, I try to, as DM, I do try to be a little bit more curt of give players the data they need to make decisions. And certainly round by round or blow by blow, I, as a player, kind of don't want to have the DM spend time trying to overwhelm me with their flowery creations. Do you think could you refine that to be more curt?
I'm trying actually very hard to do this, and this is actually incredibly difficult, but I've been experimenting with this. But one of the things, I'll give you just a couple of pieces of information from her instructions, her new version of her instructions, which is not what I was using in the stream. I told her, describe new locations initially in vivid detail, setting the scene for exploration and discovery.
Great.
Second, when asked questions about a location you've already described, keep answers brief, offering only essential details without expanding unnecessarily.
Got it.
And so I was testing her on this, and I was trying, I kept hitting her with stuff with, like, okay, I have a new character and he's approaching the keep, describe the road to the keep. And she would give a nice long flowery description. Right. And then I would try to pick up on some detail and go, oh, she mentioned the banners fluttering on the parapets. It would say, what emblem is on the banners? And she would still use a bunch of text, right? And I was just like, I think maybe it's difficult for her to know where that line is, right? Because there are cases where I'm like, yeah, when we're in mid-combat, or even just like I said, if I'm just asking follow-up questions, how many guards are there? What kinds of weapons do they have, right? I just want the quick information back. Yeah. I don't want, I don't want her to drone on and on about, you know, about what the guards look like. It's been very difficult, though. I have not yet solved this problem. So it's something I'm actively working on, but I've not solved it.
Fascinating.
Yeah.
Is that, for my own edification, is that emblematic of how a lot of human DMs do it now? Like, is that how Mercer does it on Critical Role, of like everything's flowery all the time? Or is that...
No, I don't think so. I think they have an instinct of when to be flowery versus when not, right? If you were that flowery on every single response, it gets old real fast, right? Yeah, I totally agree that it should be. But I don't want it never, right? That's the problem, is I don't want it never. I want it sometimes, right? I want, you know, I like the description when I'm in new areas, right? And I like that, like, when she's inventing the next cave or something, she would often add lots of details that I'm like, okay, there's a gem stuck in the ceiling that's glowing. Yeah. There's etchings in the floor. Mm-hmm. There's all these interesting things. Honestly, one of the things I've said, this is my favorite thing about playing with an AI, is that it is utterly impossible to tell which of those details are important and which are not. Because I don't even know if there is that distinction for the AI, right? She's probably just throwing stuff in, and only by me focusing on it does it actually become important.
Yeah.
So
I feel that it's constantly really wants to do improv. It, like, so if you ask about it, it became important. She's got more to say about it. So I feel that it's constantly on the end of improv, and that we are Like the I don't know, the joke that's not a joke that I make nowadays is, it's funny that we've built these software systems that the thing that it's worst at is basic arithmetic. And, you know, you've pointed out, if you ask it to do like point by for a character in D&D or Fearful Ends, it frequently doesn't get the point by right. And, you know, the idea of like, there's no secret door here. It's kind of hard to wrangle it into telling us no about something like that. I got at least two more really critical questions that I want to get in here, Paul, if it's okay, before I run out of time.
Yeah, go for it.
First of all, the voice activation, is that just part of ChatGPT here? Because I'm embarrassed, but I was surprised that you were it worked great on the stream, and I didn't realize you could normally interact with ChatGPT by voice. Is that a standard thing now?
Yep.
Okay.
Definitely.
Okay.
Unlocks
so right off the bat, as a complete novice, like you need to say that you're talking to the AI, because right off the bat I was like, what? And I know I just embarrassed the crap out of myself. But that was news to me.
It was not originally shipped with GPT, right? This is a newer feature that's been added.
Right.
Okay. But it is part of what I was like, oh, this is, you know, yes, being able to talk and hear her talk back to me, right? Like, this is what makes it fun for me. I wouldn't want to just sit there and be reading to myself.
For RP, for DMing, that's huge. That's actually huge. The verbal interaction, that's what the game form is traditionally about. So that actually is a major leap. I mean, obviously it's two things that have been around for a while now being connected up together. I shouldn't be super surprised by that, but it makes a huge difference. Now, far more importantly is that you know, you fed the B2 adventure into it, and can it read maps?
Ha. No, I don't think that it can. Right? It clearly led some of the entries, right? You think it can? You think it can read the maps?
I think it. It seems to. I mean, I don't have any. The evidence seems to say yes to me. Two points. The layout of the ogre cave, it got right on. And so you walk in the ogre cave, and you were like, "Oh, the ogre's right here." That seems surprising. No, that's absolutely what. Well, it's at least close to what the adventure is like, right? There's a front cave and there's a back annex. That's exactly what the ogre cave is like in B2. And the topology of the entryway to the keep, it basically got right on. So you walk in past the main gate, there's a courtyard. To the left, there's the blacksmith. And there's no, as far as I know, there's no text description of the layout of any of those places, so there is
a lot of text description. I think that's the thing. No, I don't think it can read the maps. But if you like, one of the things I was wondering about is just the tone, right, of like how she was describing stuff. So I went and spent some time rereading B2, and most of the descriptions, right, and it's dense text here, right, very dense text. Yep. And it's mostly about physicality of like, here are the locations and here's what it looks like. And right. It doesn't get into flowery speech, right? It doesn't get into flowery description, but it gives a lot of detail. Likewise, sure. I think you could probably just from the text kind of intuit how many caves there are and what's inside them, you know, at first blush. So I feel like it got a lot of that from the module.
I'm more looking at the entryway to the keep, I think is more. Yeah. Is a better point of evidence, because I don't see any description that you come in and then turn left, which she got right. I don't see any description. I mean, the entry yard is area 3. The blacksmith is area 8. The numbering on the map is all crazy, not really in any order. And she absolutely got correct that the entry, you go in the entry yard, you turn left, you're at the blacksmith. Those pieces of text aren't anywhere next to each other in the book. And I don't see any description that they're linked in any way. So, I don't understand how a system could read a map like that, but she got that right, and I don't see any link in the text between those.
Yeah. I don't think she can understand maps. And here's the interesting thing. This might just be apophenia, Dan, but one of the interesting things that of the other piece of research, big research that Adam Flynn sent me, is using AI to create a dungeon map. And It's a great little article because it talks about like how he originally just asked, hey, GPT, can you create a dungeon map for me? And the immediate response is like, no, I can't do that. Like it does. ChatGPT is not really good at that kind of like nonlinear physical space. Okay. He then in this article, they then use D2 declarative diagramming as a text based language to describe nodes and connections. To then teach it how to create a dungeon map and then use that output to feed into imaging software to actually create a dungeon map to surprising success, which is very interesting.
Yeah.
In the article, the author had to spend a lot of time training the AI of like, here is how declarative diagramming works and here's how nodes and connections, right? Because, you can get it to a point where you can describe.
I wonder if it would accept an adjacency matrix. And the funny thing is I've considered, like in the past, Paul, I've considered designing dungeons in that same way for a totally different reason. So I've actually brushed up on that as an idea in the past.
It would be an interesting experiment to see if you could give it access to an actual dungeon map and try to see how closely it can follow it. It was something that I definitely assumed right off the top that the AI is going to be terrible at. Certainly, most of the areas I explore had a feeling of linear. How do I want to say this word? The areas I was exploring felt very linear to me, right? Only rarely was I given a choice of like, you can go left or right. Right. It was mostly like, oh, here's an entrance to another cave. Here's another, there's one exit. Only by searching for secret doors did I find an exit, or like in the second adventure with the dwarf, right? It was very linear until the point where I was like very insistent about finding a back door out. So
there's an interesting.
There was a point in that, I think, when I was leaving where I was in a tunnel and she said the tunnel splits and it goes left and right, because that's the first time I saw her as an AI giving me that kind of option. Like, well, it splits. Nice.
Okay. And there's an interesting comment on this point by Kyle Iridan here in the chat saying, I've given ChatGPT a geographical layout to consider and it could respond to those features, but I haven't tried it based on an upload of a graphical map.
Yeah, and I think the probability is high that it would start to hallucinate and create physical impossibilities accidentally, right? That it would, But I was mapping as we played, and it is something I want to experiment with more and play with a little more, because I'm curious if I map as I do normally in D&D, like how good. Because I was also excited to originally I was thought like I'm going to have a very vague map that's just point to point without a lot of details. But I realized I could ask her things like, how big is this room? And she would tell me, how long is this tunnel? She would tell me, right? She would make it up. So I'm like, okay, I'm going to push on this and see see if she's able to make something sensible.
Yes. It's a good thing.
I want to address something coming up in the chat. There's a lot of discussion here about everyone being a little... thrown by Martha's pronouns. I have a picture of Martha. I'm just going to share it. This is Martha that I put on screen while we're playing. As Dan mentioned, there's a voice, right? Because I use the voice transcription. Somebody asked in the stream why I named her Martha. I wanted her to have a human veneer, right? I wanted her to seem like a person, right? I wanted it to seem like I was talking to a person. The default voice mode is a female voice, so that's why I made her female. Martha was just the first name to pop into my head. This image also generated by AI. This is from the Firefly. I know that we've talked about this, I think, before, is we like to use Adobe Firefly for AI-generated art because it is trained only on art that Adobe owns licenses to, so it's a little more ethically sourced. I was like, I want a picture of Martha on screen while we're playing. So there she is. Hi, Martha. I don't have her hooked up. She can't respond.
I was wondering if you'd do that for the stream today, actually.
I should have thought of that.
There's another piece. There's another comment I got to bring up here, Paul. So while we've been discussing this, our friend Joshua has said a couple times that he thought, and he's pretty experienced with the Claude chat program, that he thought that Claude might do better with things like rules adjudications than what we've seen with ChatGPT. And so while we've been talking, Joshua said, I just tried this, uploaded a JPEG image to Claude, and I guess asked a couple of questions about the layout, kind of nailed it. So thank you, Joshua, for trying that out.
And in fact, I say I at work, I use Claude for analyzing code much more than GPT. I find Claude does a better job reasoning about code. So Claude may have some better abilities to reason about structure. I don't know if Claude has a voice mode though, so I think I'm going to stick with GPT. I might be wrong on this. I use Claude through the Cursor IDE. So usually I'm editing code in Cursor, and it's hooked into Claude. So I usually don't directly access Claude. So I'd be curious, I guess, if Claude can do this stuff. Might be interesting to try some of these experiments with Claude.
Fascinating.
So,
and I gotta say, the dialogue with the blacksmith was lovely. The dialogue with the blacksmith just really made me really happy. Yeah. That was great. Yeah.
You know, I feel like, you know what I would,
dialogue seems like it's doing really well with that.
I want to lean a little bit more into that because I've seen some other transcripts of folks. That the Sunless Citadel article that I mentioned that Adam sent me is very interesting because it runs a very specific adventure. This is a case where he tried to chain the GPT to like run this module. And it's very interesting because some of the prompting even includes very specifics like the player should interact with these two factions and this is the main bad boss and there should be a climactic scene at some point with this boss, right? So you're really trying to push, like, this is the content I want you to run. And it's very interesting, right? Because in this case, the author is creating it to then hand off to other people to run and gather feedback about how well did the AI do. That's a little bit more than I want to give my AI because I don't want to know. I don't want to know, right? I want you to make stuff up for me, AI. I don't want to know ahead of time how anything about how the adventure is going to go. Where was I going with this? In the transcript of that, there was some examples of conversations that the player had with a kobold, and absolutely the kobold voice is in this kind of like broken English, you know, single syllable word, you know, kobold speak, which I thought was delightful. So I'm kind of, I kind of want to lean into that a little bit more. I want to see if I can get Martha to do voices. Like, I'm sure she won't, she'll just use her normal voice, but wouldn't it be delightful if I could tell her to, like, you know, there are settings in ChatGPT to give different voices. Like, I don't know if it's possible, but it'd be amazing if she changed her voice for some of the NPCs.
Wouldn't that be
hilarious?
Wow.
I would love if she could do that. I'm skeptical that I'll be able to make it happen, but
Fascinating.
Yeah. It's funny. I haven't run B2 in a long time, so I totally forgot about the fact that the ogre really is just there, and it 100% surprised me. But totally looking back at it now, like, yeah, a lot of that description was stolen straight from B2, right? Of it, like, sitting in the center and being slovenly and smelly. And I don't know if B2 talks about it actually eating its own goblin guards. That was an interesting
detail. Oh, it doesn't have goblin guards. It doesn't have goblin guards. Well, the whole addition of the goblin guards was all added. Yeah, no,
that's
they're potentially the goblins and the ogres live next to each other, and they have a tense, you know, it could be opponents, could be friends, and if you invade, if you invade the goblin compound, what they do is they run out and they throw a sack of money at the ogre in order to convince him to help them because they don't normally help each other.
That's fascinating. Well, I adore the idea that the ogre is this horrific overlord of its minions, and it sometimes treats them as tasty snacks.
Weird, creepy element. I agree that that's something I wouldn't have come up with. And as somebody said near the start, like the best D&D is kind of a hallucination. So the fact that it took these two pieces and kind of mashed them up in a way that we didn't expect, I actually thought that was a weird, nice, creepy element.
Yeah. Dan, we have gone too long. We are out of time. Do you have any final thoughts on Martha, the AI DM?
It occurs to me that there's a nice possibility here for a nice possible combination between really old school D&D dungeon presentation that was super curt and was just the facts, ma'am, right? And to begin with, it was just monster, treasure, the end, combined with, and the DM would have to flesh all that stuff out in the details of the rooms improvisationally on the fly. And it occurs to me that specifically for what we like to talk about with really old school D&D, that there might be an interesting combination between super curt dungeon presentation and the AI DM elaborating that on the fly. And I'm wondering how curt you could make it, or if like someone like myself or one of our great patrons could design in advance a very brief dungeon, how brief would we have to make it to feed it into Martha and then have you, Paul, run through it as a player in a preset dungeon that you don't know about in advance? I think that's a possible experiment we could run.
Probably, yeah. Yeah, I don't see why not. Be interesting. Yeah. Yeah, that's
I think I'd like to try writing a very short dungeon with some surprises in it, and then see how Martha presents that as a DM to you.
I mean, the other way to go about this is to say, have a video game company that is developing video games in the standard way with all the rules and mechanics built in, but then has plugins for AI, so AI can influence the generation of the content and add the flowery speech and the hallucinations and et cetera. So maybe if somebody worked for such a video game company like that, they could develop that sort of thing.
It's nice.
I will go back. Here's a crazy anecdote that I want to end with. 5-10-ish years ago, I was the lead engineer for a game called Star Trek Timelines, and I happened to be sent out to Las Vegas to the big Star Trek convention that was out there to sit on a panel back when that convention was still happening. Super fun. I was on a panel with someone from the company that had made the VR game Bridge Crew, I think it was called. And basically, it was just a VR, right, when VR was still super hot. I mean, VR still a thing, but it was having a moment at that point in time. And they made a game where basically you put on the VR and you're in the bridge of a starship, right? And you get to play out with your friends who are also in VR being manning the bridge crew of a starship. And somebody asked at that panel, you know, first of all, everybody was amazed. They were like, this is the most brilliant use of VR plus Star Trek ever. And they were asking, you know, Are you trying to get to a point where you've implemented the holodeck? And I answered that question as, that has been the goal of the video game industry forever and continues to be so. That's what we're shooting for, folks. 100%.
Amazing.
Yeah.
Fantastic. Okay, well, viewers, we'll look forward to seeing where the next steps are.
Yeah. Viewers, if you have opinions on using AI as your DM, thoughts on how to expand on that, had prompts to add or other plugins to use, or research that you've found out there of people trying experiments and documenting their findings, I'd love to see it. Please post that your thoughts in the comments section of the YouTube video. Maybe I will take that with me into my day job, or maybe that will spin up a new exciting conversation for Dan and I down the road.
Definitely. And of course, remember, you can like, follow, and subscribe to us. We're on sites like YouTube and Twitch and Facebook and TikTok and GitHub, and we do have the handle Wandering DMs on all of the sites, so please look for us there and invoke that like button. You'll get updates on upcoming shows.
If you prefer to listen to our show in audio-only podcast format, you can do so. Those files are available on our website at wanderingdms.com. You can also find our podcasts on various podcast carriers like iTunes and Spotify and Pocket Cast. If you're listening to us right now on one of those sites and they offer the ability to do so, please rate and review our show. That helps other users of that site find us, and we really appreciate it.
We really do. And of course, huge thanks to our patrons who support the show. You make the show here so much better. If you'd like to join them, please visit patreon.com/wanderingdms. And like Paul said at the top of the hour, every single tier gets you access to our private Discord server with the conversations continuing round the clock. And we will be there in about 10 minutes for our live video after chat. And we have more to say, and I'm sure that our viewers have more to say. So we would love to see you there among our patrons in the After Chat. Now, Paul, let's talk a little bit about what's coming up on the show. I want to see another episode with Martha the AI DM. Do you have that on the schedule at the moment?
It's not scheduled yet, but definitely something I'm interested in doing. So hopefully you'll see that announced soon. So watch our socials, join our Patreon and get in on the Discord. That is the best way to stay on top of what new content we're creating.
That's true nowadays. And I think that we also have a special episode coming up next Sunday. Am I right about that?
That is true. We have an interview with Tom McGrenery from the podcast Fear of a Black Dragon. Very excited for this one. I will note to folks that this is a pre-recorded interview that we will be airing due to the extreme time difference between us and Tom. Simply not possible for him to appear in our normal time slot. It'd be the wee hours of the morning for him. So we pre-recorded an interview with him, which we will be airing in our normal time slot next week.
But it's a great, dense interview. I had a lot of fun talking with Tom, actually. So I hope people will join in and see that when we run it for the first time Sunday in our normal time slot, 1 p.m. Eastern time next week. And other stuff. So I've got more shorts coming up this week from our visit to the battleship New Jersey, other little fascinating tidbits. Then I will point out that every short there gets somewhat more dangerous than the prior ones. So do look out for that. And again, Paul and I will also be appearing at RPGCon, Rising Phoenix Game Con in Massachusetts in April. And we'll be doing one of our live dungeon design dashes and actually running it in a couple sessions in the following days. So if you're in Massachusetts around that time, we would love to see you. We'd love to have you join us here at Rising Phoenix Game Con. Okay. That's enough on the docket. Am I right, Paul?
I think so. Man, Wandering DMs is pumping out the content these days.
We are with a little help from our friends. So don't forget, we are we're almost always live. Next week we are on tape, but we are here doing something every Sunday at 1 p.m. Eastern time. So we really hope you'll join us again next week for another thought-provoking discussion.
We'll see you then.